Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this weekend's edition. Also your host throughout the week on our website and podcast, kereport.com and Corlin Economics Report. We had another busy week full of company interviews and analyst interviews, a lot focused on resources, but also some broad market comments. I am kicking off the show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, to bring everybody up to speed with Matt, MJG Capital is a fund focused on investing in resource stocks and even down to some of the smaller resource stocks. Now, Matt, last time you and I chatted was back in the middle of January in, I guess we can call it more the middle of that correction in precious metals, but that was also at the time that base metals were running higher. There's been a lot of activity in the junior space, a lot of money raised, and a lot of news that's come out just in the last couple of weeks. I want to start off with a focus on your fund. How active has MJG Capital been during these last, let's say, 5 months?
Firstly, Corey, it's great to be back on the program here. It has been a few months since we've caught up. I think this should be a pretty timely update. And I hope to find you well, despite the slow vaccine rollout in Canada. I feel fortunate enough to have gotten my second jab a couple Fridays to go, and it's nice to be able to venture out into the world here. In terms of MJG, since we spoke in January, we've been very quiet, at least in terms of initiating new positions. So far this year, we've only initiated two new positions in the fund, both via private placement, one in Q1, and then one more recently in April here. I've really been sticking with the mantra of, be right, sit tight. And it's been working out well for us. And we already have a full portfolio that's most entirely deployed. And so not desperately looking for new names to add to the portfolio by any stretch. So really, really picking our opportunities. And I think that's the right mentality in this market environment, 1 year already well positioned. In terms though of buying, we have been solidifying some of our existing holdings that have maybe underperformed or not caught the buzz that we've seen with plenty of juniors across the space here. And I often feel that sometimes the best place to look for new purchases is within your existing portfolio, and you got to look at it through clear eyes. You don't want to be deluding yourself. But assuming that the thesis is still intact and the company hasn't moved, where better to look than the opportunities you already know best? So some examples of names that we've been buying in recent months, and this is all through placing limit orders and being patient. A few of the names would be Alta Strategies, Africa-focused royalty generator, Golden Valley Mines, which is a name I've written about probably for a good two and a half years here in the MJG investor letter that goes out every 6 months. Sama Resources, that's another name I've covered in the investor letter. Lara Exploration. So these are names that I'm picking away at, have a high degree of confidence in the people involved. The theses at each of the stories still remain intact. And, I think they're likely to get some love as this market progresses here.
Hey, so Matt, the stocks that you brought up there, they're, in all fairness, very diversified. You have an African-focused royalty play. We have a nickel exploration company. I want to ask you then, what right now is the balance in terms of the positions and resources that the MJG Capital portfolio is focused on? Can you break that down for us, please?
Sure. It's a good question. And I'll just say simply, we have a broad natural resource mandate. So at the moment, we're entirely focused on mining equities, and this goes as early stage as prospect generation and as, you know, late stage as either producing miners or more frequently in our portfolio, the royalty players. You know, technically within our mandate, we also have agriculture, you know, water, forestry, proteins. But at the moment, we're very, very much honed in on metals and mining. Funny enough, and we were chatting about this a little bit before the interview, you know, you'll come to these points in the market, and it's happened twice in the past 12 months. First was summer of last year, especially as we headed into July, August timeframe, where precious metals were absolutely ripping. Juniors were doubling and tripling in price. We have the gold price, you know, trading up to all-time highs near 2,100 an ounce. And I had multiple folks, both investors in the partnership and those otherwise saying, hey, why don't you focus, you know, entirely on precious metals? This is clearly the place to be. I feel like you're missing out. Well, sure enough, you know, August comes to pass. We go into early September. And as plenty of your witnesses, listeners, I'm sure, have witnessed, we've now corrected here for a good 7 or 8 months in precious metals. It looks like we've turned the corner over the past 4 to 8 weeks. So that's encouraging. But of course, right when folks are saying you should be going all in on PMs, that's the moment where you should be looking elsewhere. And just in February of this year, when the battery metal, the energy metal, equities were rocking, those narratives were really gaining traction. I heard the same thing. You should be all in on EV metals. You should be all in on these metals that help power our 21st century lifestyle. And my response is, well, we're well positioned, but no, we already have a pretty narrow mandate. I think chasing the flavor of the month, if anything, is counterproductive. And you're also, you know, unnecessarily limiting the opportunities that you have to invest. So long story short, we're pretty well diversified, I'd say, at least within the metals and mining space. At the moment, we sit, you know, we're roughly 45% weighted towards the energy metals, as I call them. That would include copper. That would include uranium. That would include nickel, vanadium, rare earths. You know, roughly 40% weighted to precious metals at the moment. That's entirely through gold and silver. We don't have any substantial PGM exposure at the moment, but that could change. There's not a specific reason for that. And then more recently, in the past few months here, we're now up to 15% exposure to the ag minerals. And that's partially due to a position we initiated in Q1 of this year that has nearly tripled in price. And so that's lifted up our weighting there to both phosphate and potash, which I think are going to be great places to be over the coming few years. And those stories are just getting going here.
Matt, I want to ask you about how you manage some of your positions when you do see pops like that. You've already mentioned an ag mineral stock that went up 3 times just this year. We can also tie that into some of the early stage exploration plays, or even slightly more advanced exploration plays that run up before drill results are announced. And with all the drill programs just beginning, we have already started to see this action again. Are you actively trading some of these positions if you do see them rise ahead of any significant news?
Yeah, I think that's prudent, in all honesty. I mean, we have internal portfolio kind of controls or rules of thumb, at the very least, that I stick by in terms of position sizing. So the absolute most that I would commit to a single position is 10% of the fund, which is actually a very, very high number. But it's 10% at cost. And then assuming we make an investment and it does very well, the maximum position I'd be comfortable with is 20% at market. So 10% at cost, 20% at market. And so that could be one reason to sell right there. If we go above that 20% threshold, that's already a very healthy weighting. And so that right there would be a reason to take profits. But as you mentioned, oftentimes in this space, at least in bull markets, like we've seen in recent months, you'll see the share price rally in anticipation of news or based purely on changes in sentiment. So I think if a share price moves, you want to distinguish whether it's due to changes in sentiment or anticipation from the market, or whether it's due to a fundamental development on the company level that actually justifies the share price move. And if you have an opportunity, you get involved in a position and it goes up 2x or 3x purely because people are excited about an upcoming drill program or they're anticipating a potential takeout, or they're getting excited about the metal of focus or the commodity of focus, like ag minerals, for instance, like we discussed. I do think it's a good opportunity to take your cost basis off the table, and then at that point, you can still have a healthy weighting, but you're playing with the house's money. And once you're in that position, you can make more informed decisions going forward. So, really, you want to look at it, on a case by case basis. But that's generally how I'll decide. You know, firstly, is the move justified by a fundamental company specific development? If yes, then maybe we'll hold the entire position. Is it based off of hype or speculation? If that's the case, then I'd be more willing to take some or all of our initial capital off the table.
Okay, thanks for that update. Now, one other thing that you mentioned at the very start here is that the two new positions that you have entered were through private placements, especially for the precious metals sector. Even while it was going through that 8-month correction, there was still a lot of money being raised. There still is a lot of money being raised. This has been a large financing window for the sector. And some of the analysis that I get on the back of these financings, I think, is fairly flawed. A lot of people really rip into companies for when they're issuing these half warrants. Sometimes, if the terms are right, I don't have a problem with that. How do you go about analyzing these individual news events when a company is raising money to, I guess, give you the confidence that the story's still moving forward, this is a good financing, or on the flip side, this was a bad financing and it decreases your interest in the company?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And you're absolutely right. Money has been flowing across the junior space, whether you're talking about the precious metal names or the energy metal names. Just recently, we've seen close to a dozen silver companies come to market right here. And I'm actually supportive of that from the issuer's perspective, at least. I think in this type of market environment, the money's on the table. It's worth taking it. We're definitely in a euphoric market environment currently. And I think it's quite possible that the general market or the broader market rolls over here in the coming months. And the junior space can get, smacked right on the lip for no fault of its own. So I think it makes sense not to get too greedy and cash up if the appetite is there. You know, as I continue to invest and accumulate experience in this space, I am becoming a little bit less attached, one could say, to full warrant financing, at least in this current market environment. So, generally, if I'm looking at a company's financing and trying to evaluate whether it's an opportunity or not, I actually try to put the financing to the side for a moment, ignore the terms, ignore whether there's a half warrant, full warrant, or no warrant attached, and just look at the company itself. You know, starting with the people involved, are they folks that I trust? Are they folks that have made money for me in the past, or friends of mine money in the past? Are they well incentivized? Are they well suited for the task at hand? Then look at the asset. You know, then look at the upcoming catalyst, the company structure, the valuation at this level. All that good stuff. So really try to look at it from a bottom-up perspective, not get too enticed by the deal terms one way or another. Then you evaluate whether the company fits within your current portfolio. Maybe it's an interesting opportunity, but you already have too much exposure or enough exposure to a certain jurisdiction or a certain metal. You know, that could be a reason to say no. And then in terms of evaluating the specific financing, I think you'd want to look towards the company's previous financings and see whether this is a step in the right direction. You know, are they raising at a higher share price? If they're including a half warrant, maybe they included a full warrant in their previous two deals. So that's a step in the right direction. You know, conversely, you can have companies that raise money with ease in previous financings, maybe without including a warrant at all. And if you see a full warrant attached, you know, that's a potential opportunity and it's something worth digging into, but it could also be a sign that something's badly awry. So I think you want to look at the terms and the structure of the deal relative to previous financings, and that can give you a decent sense of whether the company's on the right trajectory. But one way or another, you don't want to get too tied up in the actual terms of the deal. As far as I'm concerned, focus on whether this is a story that you'd like to invest in, you know, if working capital was not an issue.
Absolutely. Make sure they are doing, the company is doing the work that you think can provide those catalysts, because there's a lot of companies out there right now doing work, but not all projects are the same and not all work programs are the same either. Let's talk about one specific deal that caught a lot of attention back in the middle of May. That's Filo Mining, traded FIL on the Venture Exchange. The company came out with a huge drill hole. It got a lot of attention. It caused the stock to more than double in a very short period of time. The drill result was 858 meters of 1.8% copper equivalent. What's your takeaway from this hole? Filo Mining, it already was, I think, a pretty solid company, but how important was this drill result to the continued story here?
It's exciting. It's exciting for the junior space as well. This really gets folks' speculative juices flowing when you have a bona fide discovery. And this is no doubt a tier one team backed by tier one people. And it's genuinely shaping up to be a tier one deposit here. I certainly don't fault anyone for owning Filo at the current levels, even if they're initiating the position from scratch. And I do know quite a few folks that were positioned in the story before the discovery. So major kudos to them. They're friends of mine who are participating in the $1.85 placement back in mid last year. So they're sitting quite pretty here. We don't own Filo ourselves in the MJG fund. We're already very well weighted towards copper at about 25 to 30% of the overall portfolio, and also we have 7 copper focused names, which is a lot for a portfolio with 20 to 25, you know, core positions at any given time, and one of those larger holdings is a company called Nova Royalty, which already has significant exposure to Argentina, given that their flagship asset is NSR over First Quantum's Taca Taca project. So we've steered clear, but I don't fault anybody for owning at current levels. I will say there were folks out there on social media, you know, banding this about as the best drill hole of the past decade. I think that's demonstrably not true. It was an absolute screamer of a hole, potentially the best hole of this year. I guess for some context, I went back and looked at the, you know, true discovery hole at the Timok project in Serbia. And this is going back nearly a decade, 9 years ago into 2012. And, you know, the Filo hole you mentioned, 858 meters at 1.8% copper, incredible intercept. It included a high-grade portion, sub-interval of 163 meters at 5.4% copper equivalent from 780 meters. So, again, excellent hit. But for some context, if you look back and look at the true discovery hole at Timok, management actually was declaring hole 1210, the discovery hole. But I think 1213 is what really tagged into the high grade upper zone there. We saw 160 meters at 10% copper equivalent from 460 meters. So we're looking at nearly double the grade over the same width. At close to half of the depth, 460 meters compared to 780. So I think that puts it in, you know, I just want to put it in perspective for listeners not to get too carried away. I guess a couple other points of note observations here. The first is, you know, I would say pretty definitively the Lundin family is not going to let this company go. As far as I'm concerned, they're going to take this into production however long it takes. And this district, which includes the discovery, but also the nearby Jose Maria project, which is held by Lundin as well in a separate vehicle. I think those ultimately go together. That could happen, you know, in the near term or matter of a few years here. And I think later this decade, we could even see the asset absorbed into Lundin Mining itself. So I get the sense that the Lundin family is not looking to cash in on this project anytime soon. And their hope is that it's going to be in the family producing for decades to come. Look, there's a lot of difficulties with this project. There are a lot of hurdles to overcome, even with the excitement around the discovery. I mean, the project is straddling a border between two antagonistic countries, Argentina and Chile. And it's going to have to advance through the permitting tracks in both of those countries, realistically. So it's going to take quite some time. Eventually, due to the altitude of the project, it's way up there in the Andes. The project is at risk if we do truly see a glacier law push through in either of these countries. And I don't ultimately think that will come to pass, but it's a possibility if a leftist government comes in any other country. So the project could be in the crosshairs there. Then there's the high cost of exploration at these altitudes and in these remote regions. The company would be lucky if they were able to drill for $1,000 a meter. I think their shorter programs were closer to $1,500 a meter. They're drilling year round. They can likely get down to $1,000. That's extremely expensive. I mean, that's an order of magnitude more expensive than what you'd be seeing if you're drilling closer to home in places like Nevada or in Quebec. The final point here would be, water accessibility is a potential concern. I know management says full-throatedly that they're not concerned. There's plenty of water available in Argentina. There are quite a few hurdles and boxes that need to be checked. I do, however, think it's the right team to do it. It's just going to take some time, and it's going to take some patience. So I think investors that are invested currently, there's a couple ways to do it. You can play drill hole to drill hole and hope that we see better results in this coming batch of assays than we saw in hole 41. Or you could take the longer-term approach and say, I trust the Lundins. This is a monster of a project. I'm going to buy these shares, put it in a dresser drawer for a few years and not worry about it and let them build value and check through these lists of things that need to be done before the project can actually be developed. So we're steering clear, but it's an incredible discovery and one that should be on everybody's radar, even if just out of academic interest.
So on the back of that Filo hole, look, it's just another sign of the market that if you drill some good holes, the market is taking notice. Wrap us up then, Matt, with any other companies, any other drill results that have caught your eye over these last number of months, please.
Sure. I mean, one that has caught my eyes, caught the attention of the market has been Zach Flood and Francis McDonald's Canorlin Minerals and their continued success at the Renault project in Quebec. For those not following, Kenneland is a prospect generator driven by two very intelligent but young and ambitious geologists. And they have projects primarily in Quebec and then in Alaska. Those are kind of their two areas of focus at the moment. And to these guys' credit, they started the company in pretty ugly markets, so they're able to stake large land packages. And they're aggressive. They're swinging for the fences, for better or for worse. They're not looking for small deposits here in either of those jurisdictions. So Renault is their most advanced asset. Sumitomo is their joint venture partner there and just earned an 80% stake. So Canorlin has, some exposure to continued success there. And, to my understanding, they've just come out with the first batch of assays from the winter program. We have another 15 holes or so to go. They've reported roughly half of the results. And then such as Sumitomo's excitement about what's going on at Renault, we have a 20,000-meter program that's being prepared as we speak. So it's full speed ahead there. Very exciting for shareholders. We've been involved with Zach's group since early 2020. That's treated us very well. I think, on a split adjusted basis, our first investment in the company was at 25 cents. But we since doubled down on their most recent financing at a dollar because I like how they're going about their business and the opportunity there. So Canorlin's one that's been exciting. It's not a holding of ours, but I'm following, Jean-Marc Lulan's, Azimut, discovery at Elmer. I think that's bringing some excitement to the James Bay region. He goes about business the right way. Incredibly smart individual, not promotional. So he stands out from a lot of the leaders of these juniors that we follow. And I'm hoping for the best there. We own a company called Harfang Exploration, led by Francois Goulet, who's exploring just to the southeast. of the discovery at Elmer there. And you're, I mean, you're right. Just in a general sense, this is a discovery market, and expect it to continue and maybe even gain traction here. You know, folks like Rick Rule out there saying that 2022 is set to be the year of the explorer. I'm sure there's some, you know, book talking there to some degree, but I would generally echo those sentiments, especially as these higher quality development projects continue to be taken out one by one. The cupboard is increasingly bare, and for the first time in decades, we're gonna see the major miners going much farther down the food chain than they have, and start to explore, whether it's brownfields, greenfields, all of the above. I think the well-managed prospect generators and explorers with respected teams and, you know, the ability to bring in partners are going to be in great shape here. So in the MJG fund, we're pretty far up the food chain here. I think our median market cap is around 60 million. So hopefully the market trends in this direction, and we have a bit of a golden era here for explorers and the like.
All right, Matt. Hey, it's great having you on the show. Thanks for taking time on these two extended segments. We covered a lot, but you know what? There is a lot to talk about. It's an exciting time for the resource sector and the whole way down to the juniors, because a lot of them do have money and there's a lot of work going on. So it's just a different world than 5-6 years ago, that's for sure. Matt, thank you as always for your time. Again, Matt is managing partner at MJG Capital. Pleasure having you on the show, Matt. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Corey. We'll do this again soon.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am chatting with Sean Broderick in this segment. He is an analyst over at Weiss Ratings. Sean and I speak on a every 2-week basis, talking about a wide range of markets. But one trend that we've picked up on a lot of your recent writing here, Sean, deals with the inflation trade and how to actually invest in this inflation trade if you are along the mindset that inflation is here and only picking up. Let's start off with your general outlook for inflation. We saw some recent data for last month, actually now 2 months ago, on inflation in the US that exceeded all expectations. Now everyone's wondering, is it transitory? Is it not transitory? What do you think about the whole inflation trade? What's driving it? How sustainable is it?
Right. Well, what most people have to realize is the Fed has a very definite view on inflation, which is that inflation is very transitory. We are having some prices heat up now. They're very certain those price rises will go away by the end of the year at the latest. So they think we're only looking at a short-term thing. I think they're wrong. I think they have to talk this because they have to keep people buying their bonds, because we actually fund our own government now, rather than selling most of our debt overseas. And they're really between a rock and a hard place. You can see inflation coming. And so I think that inflation is going to run hotter than the Fed expects for the next few years anyway. Now, they've been wrong the last few months, and they said that was unexpected. But again, they think it'll be very transitory. But it's like everything is going up. The price of food, the price of meat, aluminum, lumber, copper, pretty much everything. Even the polysilicon, which is used in solar panels, is soaring right now over in China. There's all kinds of squawking about that because it's really putting pricing pressure on that. So the cost of solar panels could go higher. So there's many, many things heading up higher. Part of this is really due to, everyone stayed at home for a year and they couldn't spend. Now they're coming out and they're opening up their wallets and using all the money they saved up. That's part of it. And also part of it is an economic and inflationary cycle that was in place anyway. It was just delayed. And so now it's coming back with a vengeance. And if you look at things like oil, I mean, we could be looking at a super cycle in oil, because we just saw OPEC Plus, which is the OPEC nations plus the group of non-aligned miscreants led by Russia, that they just raised the like production cap they have, and the market didn't even blink. It just pushed prices higher. That's because people are looking at the demand situation further in the year, and things look tight. Things look tight for all sorts of things. We're seeing real delays between when those companies that want to manufacture things order supplies and like when they actually get supplies. That supply chain is being dragged out and out and out time-wise. What does that do? That means some people will pay up to get things sooner, and that, again, is inflationary. So there's many different inflationary forces at work. I don't claim to know exactly how it'll work out. I'm just saying that the Fed and Wall Street are whistling past the graveyard right now, not able to come to grips with the inflationary forces we have in play. And there are great ways to play this. There are places you can do very well, not only to protect your portfolio, but also profit quite a bit. And so I'm just trying to raise people's awareness about that as well.
Sean, what about over the last almost decade when people were talking about inflation? Inflation is coming. Inflation is here. And in all fairness, where we saw inflation seemed to be in the financial markets. How are you balancing out what's different now and this inflationary environment?
Yeah, well, and that's absolutely true. For a long time, we didn't see real inflation. Only now, looking at consumer price inflation across the developed world, I mean, we're seeing prices heat up at the fastest pace in more than 12 years. On average, prices for the OECD countries was 3.3% higher in the past year. That's inflation. So never mind people who were like, you know, warning about this for so long and it never happened. Well, finally, they're right. You can say, well, you know what? It's like a stop clock. They're finally right. But why are those people right? They're right now, probably not for the reasons they actually said. There was a lot of stuff about the U.S. dollar is going to, you know, like, you know, slide way down. And the U.S. dollar has fallen, by the way. That is a part of it. It hasn't fallen nearly as much as many people expected, considering the way that we're ramping up spending. A part of this is because of the U.S. dollar's role as the international currency for trade, and there's more trade, so people need more dollars. That's helping support the U.S. dollar. But the underlying weakness is there. And so we have seen inflation. We have seen the U.S. dollar fall, but we could see it fall a lot more, which would be inflationary, at least for the U.S. We're going to see China export inflation. They've already seen their input prices go up as they bring in copper and steel and aluminum and all this stuff. And now they're going to be exporting that stuff to us. Could be a pretty expensive Christmas once that rolls around. We'll see how that goes. And yes, the point you made before about we saw inflation in financial assets, that was really because we had lots of free money flowing around. It was looking for a home. So it basically bid up stock prices, basically because you gave all the money to the people at the top. A difference now is that they're mailing out checks to poor and working class people who actually will spend every dime they get. And as all these people spend these checks they get, that becomes inflationary. But in a good way, let me just say, you want a little inflation. You just do, because deflation is, that just crunches everything. And especially for a country with the kind of debts we have, we need to grow our way out of it. And the way to do that is to get the economy going and also shrink the value of the old debts. But so what's happening is, as these people receive checks, they are spending those checks in their neighborhood and on Amazon, of course. But that's really juicing up the local economies, which is good for economic growth. That's why we're seeing all these forecasts for higher and higher economic growth. But it's also inflationary. So that's the difference between what's happening now and what happened, after the great financial crisis, when we saw the price of all these financial assets bottom and then take off. That's because it was all this money floating around in the system, and it chased those assets higher. Now we're actually putting money into the system a different way, mailing out checks to people and stuff, and adding into the other factors that I already talked about. That's really priming the economic and inflationary pumps.
So, Sean, let's refocus back on the investment angle of this then. How are you positioning your portfolios, or what are you telling your subscribers in terms of how to play this, what sounds like more sustainable inflation, true inflation trade?
Right. Well, there are many ways to trade it, and I have been making adjustments in the portfolios. In one thing people should know is in an inflationary period, we see what outperforms on Wall Street switch, because in a non-inflationary period, like we had, growth stocks outperform value stocks. And that's because there's no inflation to eat away at the value of the earnings they say they're going to have someday. You know, you can look down the road and say, those dollars 5 years from now will be worth pretty much what the dollars now is worth. So, fine. But once we get into an inflationary environment, you want your money, your value sooner. You don't want to wait way down the road. So value stocks in an inflationary environment tend to outperform growth stocks. I'm not saying people should sell all their growth stocks. What they should do is take a good hard look at them. I think the ones that will do well are those that have pricing power. So if you have a company that has pricing power and can raise its prices in an inflationary environment, then that stock will probably do okay. And so we've been adjusting our portfolio somewhat. Now, it helps that we're buying things like, you know, oil stocks and the price of oil is going higher, gold producers and the price of gold is going up, steel, copper, and all that stuff. And those things are going up. Well, those are going up now, but I think they'll continue to do well on throughout the course of this inflationary period, because they're the kind of things that really tend to do well. Uranium is another one. Boy, is that a value. It's just dirt cheap. And look what's happening in the uranium stocks recently. They're blasting off. I had one go up 14% just one day this week alone. There's a lot more good news, I think, coming for those stocks than we have seen, like, say, over the last couple years when everyone was really depressed about them. There's a real opportunity here.
So the uranium stocks, I would argue, are a bit different than a lot of the other commodity stocks, because uranium stocks have completely outperformed uranium. While you can make the argument a lot of, say, copper stocks or gold stocks or silver stocks have underperformed the rise and pop that we've seen in the underlying commodity. How are you balancing that out then, Sean?
That's true. And well, part of that at least has to do with like share issuance, stuff like that. Companies need to fund their operations. So they issued more shares, but you can't issue more physical gold, so the price of physical gold would go higher. You have to invest in the right companies, and certainly right now, at least, and it could change, but right now, those companies that have good cash flow seem to be outperforming. Of course, we say that, and then all the uranium stocks, I can only think of one that has good cash flow, and they're outperforming. Uranium might be a special case, but there's other things you can invest in as well. For example, you can invest in inflation-adjusted bonds like the SPDR Portfolio TIPS ETF, which is a very easy thing to buy. And I have recommended that to my subscribers. It's doing well. It like sends you dividends regularly. And it's just really positioned to ride this big wave. And some things will continue to underperform. I do think, though, that the next big move for the gold miners is coming. I had some stocks that were really down, but in the last couple of weeks, they've come back very nicely. Others have popped up and like racked up really nice gains. So it's kind of a balance. I don't think anyone should focus on just one thing, but there's a whole range of different investments you can make that can do very well in an inflationary period.
All right, Sean. Hey, great chatting with you, buddy. I appreciate the insights on this whole inflation trade. Look, it's on everybody's radar. Everyone's talking about inflation, and we don't know if it's going to be transitory or not, but the fact of the matter is you need to position at least some of your portfolio for the potential increase and consistent increase in inflation. One other thing to note is that Sean will be speaking at the Orlando Money Show on June the 12th. If you want more information about that, you can email me, fleck@kereport.com, and I can put you in touch with Sean to get some more information. Sean, thanks for your time this weekend. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
You too.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're sticking to more precious metals as I am chatting with Chris Ritchie. He is the president of Silvercrest Metals. Silvercrest is traded on the TSX under the symbol SIL and the NYSE under the symbol SILV. Now, Chris, you just got back from site, and in all fairness, it's been a bit of slow news flow out of the company. The most recent news release was back on May 12th, which reported Q1 financials and general updates from the project. But since you were just at site, let's get a more comprehensive update on how everything's going out there. We'll start on the construction front. What updates can you give us in terms of construction here at the company's project down in Mexico, please, at the Las Chispas project?
Great. Thanks, Corey. Yeah, I just got back from there, spent 2 weeks down at site. What I was most impressed by, first of all, was the fact that basically the city that we built, it's 520 individual units for each miner to have their own housing unit. And typically miners live with 4 to 8 people per house. So this is like luxury mining housing down there. But again, from risk mitigation, such a big focus of ours, we want to make sure that we can operate through all cycles. And some of our peers, you know, people go home at night, they have exposure, they don't have quarantine camps. So some of the productivity issues that people are seeing now, as well as, you know, if there's another wave, those are big risks. So for us, how we've handled that has been fantastic. Some of the other issues that are going really well is in a construction project, you've got tight schedules. Given that we have a fixed project, if you start to get off schedule, there is a lag and the people start waiting for their turn to get at it. You're paying for them to be there when they're not actually working. So your problems compound, and they compound pretty heavily. So the first 30% or so are really critical to stay on schedule. And so far we're on schedule, on budget. You know, the earthworks is looking fantastic. So again, risk mitigation on the construction side is looking really good on that front. Underground development, I stood 26 meters away from the Bobby Vista splay, and you've heard us talk about that. That was our last piece of news on infill drilling. So these were ounces that are not in the mine plan as it stands. So again, being 26 meters away, we're very short order away from developing those ounces. And then we'll next time we put out a new mine plan, we'll have those details in there, but you can imagine we're going after them, you know, and we want the flexibility of having access to them. So the underground development's, you know, progressing on budget, on schedule. So again, trying to have a lot of flexibility there. The stockpile itself is starting to look pretty large. Recall that we hope to have 9 months of production already sitting on the ground before we start the mill. So again, you'll hear me say it again and again on the risk management portion. That's going really well. So, you know, that's a big part of what we're doing. In terms of Ausenco, they're doing a fantastic job. You know, they certainly know what we're doing. We've got most of the tanks up now, just getting to late stages of that, which is looking great. And we still have plenty of room for drill rigs, you know, so I think we've got 7 drill rigs at Las Chispas now, and 3 over at Picacho. So again, everything's humming along nicely. I'm definitely going to be knocking on wood here, but out of the gates, and that ramp up still expected in late Q2 next year. So we're just starting to get to that point where, you know, people need to start thinking about us converting over from the traditional PNAV metric to free cash flow. And for us, that's where we really stand out.
So Chris, can you just summarize timeframes then? General timeframes when it comes for what investors should be focused on as the company does move towards that full-scale production?
Sure. I mean, generally speaking, this was a very short build, right? Usually you get into that big lull between, you know, the feasibility study starting construction and cash flow. Very short build. The drilling has been going, you know, we're doing a lot of work there. The main focus, and you'll see this probably in the next little while from more detailed news, is we're coming to conclusion on the infill drilling. So that'll probably be in the next couple of months. And that sounds kind of boring, but it's actually not. These are ounces that we're increasing the degree of confidence in. We are hopefully going to be in a position to put them into a mine plan, which means if we have higher grade material, we can, you know, prioritize that ore and take out some lower grade material. So again, we hope to make the current mine plan obsolete during that little lull between, you know, the feasibility study and cash flow, where most people aren't really able to drill. They're not really able to make much changes. You know, heard me say it before that, you know, our feasibility study was the good enough study. It was the good enough to get our money, and it was the good enough to stop the dilution. So again, in this next year, because again, late Q2 is when we hope to be getting up and running, you're still going to see a really aggressive drill program. And so that's going to be ongoing. And you're also just going to be seeing some investors starting to, you know, recognize that, to start to step in as they see the risk start to come down. So yeah, we're getting pretty close there, and charge away. You know, we'll have intermittent drill news. We'll still be pushing. Again, capital efficiency is always going to be our focus. For those of you who know us well, we added $7 of value for every dollar we spent up to the end of 2020. So that's right before construction started and whatnot. So that number will change, obviously. So again, for us, you know, so far we probably delineated close to 8 to 10 million ounces, you know, from the previous news releases on the Bobby V's display. Well, at today's prices, that has the opportunity to be close to $20 of margin. You know, for us, we're probably spent in the neighborhood of $10 million. So if it's, you know, 8 million ounces times $20 a margin, that's $160 million before tax and discounting. You're probably getting to a point where that's 10 times of your return on invested capital. So, you know, for us to sort of get that into a mine plan in the next 18 months, that's going to add value. People who are really the financial model nerds, when you turn over the calendar and people update their model and you roll the CapEx that we spent out of there, you add that back to the valuation, right? So these are things, just that passage of time, that are really going to make a big difference. And like I said, there's a whole new audience that can start to look at us when we're in production, and our liquidity is already high enough. So part of our focus with the investors is making sure people who think that's a reasonable thought process are kind of getting in before the people who need to wait for that cash flow.
Let's focus a little bit more on the drilling then. As you mentioned, the infill program, you estimate there how many ounces you guys can add. It's one thing Silvercrest has been very good at, is adding ounces to the mine plan for cheap, actually, through the drill bit. What's the update that you can give us on the infill drilling here, but then also transitioning into more of the growth aspect of the drilling, exploration?
Sure. There's twofold in the near term drilling. Is we want to make sure we don't sterilize any ounces near the infrastructure. So if you start to, you know, build your underground development and your tunnels and whatnot, if you don't have enough structure around that, you know, you might not be able to mine other ounces. So we're going to make sure we're drilling in and around that area extensively to make sure that we're getting all that low hanging fruit. And again, from a capital efficiency standpoint, that stuff's, you know, right at our fingertips. So that's the best bang for the buck. We've got a lot of other targets at Las Chispas. Now, again, with capital efficiency, you poke away, you get some results back, you scratch your head a little bit, and then you poke some more. And then for us, once we tag into something, that's when we kind of throw 2, 3, 4, 5 rigs at it. So we're systematically going through the other, you know, call it close to 35 veins that are not in the feasibility study. So again, we've got drilling for years and years to come over here. So this is part of the dialogue we have with investors is, well, your NAV's, you know, a little bit on the higher end. And I was like, well, the free cash flow versus our peers is actually really attractive. It was like, well, if you grow into it, you know, it's more interesting down the road. And I'm like, our average finding cost per ounce to date has been 85 cents an ounce. So I would encourage investors or people listening, assume that it's $3 an ounce or $4 an ounce, you know, go forward in terms of what it costs us to find a new ounce. If it's still close to $7 to take it out of the ground, you're still about $11 in terms of a true total cost to get an ounce out. You're still in the bottom quartile. But again, when you think about that, what that does for mine life, potential expansion, and also, you know, free cash flow if those ounces happen to be higher grade, it really makes a big bang. So when you think about what it means for the next 1, 2, 3, 4 years, I mean, we are going to probably double the total meters drilled over the next, you know, 18 months of all that we've done since we started the company. So again, like, this growth is just right in front of us. We're just going to be systematic. When it comes to Picacho, we're still very, very busy over there. And for those who've been following that, we put out the one news release, you know, material that's over 600 grams a ton. If we get enough to be a standalone, that's fantastic. But if we ended up just getting 1 or 2 million tons over there, massive impact for us in terms of mine life and throughput expansion at Las Chispas, because that material could be trucked over to that facility. So again, we want people to look at the 3-year program, and we want people to, you know, hopefully give us a pat on the back for being so systematic and being so diligent with people's capital.
Yeah, you guys have always been focused on the economics and how all of it fits into a general mine plan and trying to maximize, optimize that mine plan too. Chris, let's quickly get some macro comments from you regarding the precious metals sector. I know a lot of our listeners do like hearing from you in terms of what you're seeing and what you're hearing in a lot of your meetings with really larger funds, high net worth people. What are you watching for? What's the main theme here that should be the focus for precious metals investors?
Inflation. I mean, that's been on the tip of people's tongues, whereas the last few years, it has definitely not been. So the irony here is the fund flow dynamic has the potential to really be volatile. And again, people who know us well, we have some charts in our deck that show that the PE multiples tend to come down when inflation goes up. So when you look at the broader market having the success it's had for the last 10, 12 years, talking about valuation being near like all-time highs, if inflation goes up and PE multiples do follow that historic trend lower, where does that money go, right? Right now, the blow up in crypto a couple of weeks ago was about 2 times the total value of the entire precious metal cycle industry. So crypto could have, you know, could go up 100 times from here. But if people who are focused on, you know, a stable store of capital, a stable store of funds, that stable word's still in doubt. But again, then maybe there's more upside there. So, you know, people are starting to look for places to hide their money. Copper has more sensitivity to inflation than gold and silver does. And you can look what happened to the copper names in the last little while. I think some of those people are kind of probably taking some profits. So I think you're seeing a lot more people looking at the sector, but they just haven't moved their money yet. Recall, we've had 10 years of negative outflows in the precious metal sector. So that's pretty fascinating. I always look at the Crescat guy stuff. They're smart guys, and they're anyone else out there. It's worth taking a peek at this stuff or chatting with them. But they've got some really interesting charts on debt and free cash flow in the mining industry. Again, these miners have had to find religion in the last decade to clean up balance sheets. No money was available. They've got an interesting, Crescat's got an interesting chart in their presentation talking about the net debt to assets. And it's showing from their work that the mining sector, precious metal sector, is the healthiest industry out there. So as you're starting to see some volatility kick up, inflation chatter, money moving around a little bit, some things behaving a little strangely, to know that this industry as a whole is actually looking extremely healthy while no one's really paid too much attention, that's a great thing. This industry does not need prices to go higher for silver and gold. If the balance sheets and the free cash flow keep continuing, you're going to see people inching up their dividends. You're going to see the index waiting for this sector go higher, which drags in the passive funds that sort of mirror or mimic, you know, the industry weightings and the market weightings within the broader context. So we don't need it to go higher. So it kind of dovetails into us a little bit that if it goes higher, it's great. If we find more ounces, it's great. When we get to free cash flow, it's great. But we want to make sure we have a vehicle that if things go poorly for the industry or the market or everything else, we want people to have a high degree of confidence that we can weather that storm. So the industry can. I mean, that's what's really interesting right now is this is a really, really healthy industry with lots of free cash flow and really good balance sheets.
So then what are some of the key company specifics that you guys are doing to limit that downside risk, really set this company up or position this company in the precious metal space as one of those, in a way, defensive plays that has protection on the downside, but also has that upside component?
Yeah, and I mean, we sit around the table and talk about this where, you know, if you invest in gold and silver, to a certain extent, you're investing in financial disorder. So when the world's going to hell in a handbasket, people tend to run to gold and silver. These inflation number now, you're having 2 to 2.5% difference between the inflation rate and you know, 10-year bonds. So you get that those negative rates that are great for gold are getting even more negative these days. For us, this is the disorder. This is where things are getting a little strange. But we just sort of crested through our deal price of $9.20 US. We were kind of close to 10.20 last couple of days. I'm getting a lot of inbounds and a lot of people saying, well, now that you digested all that capital and, you know, some people said, oh, you raised too much money. And I say, well, I hope so. But we have the potential to have over $100 million US of excess capital to ride out a storm, to navigate any challenges, to be flexible with our mine plan, to drill more aggressively. So that it's not only gold and silver is good to go to in a bad market or financial disorder. We want our company to withstand that, right? So that $7 all-in sustaining cost and that balance sheet that it can hopefully take a few really nasty surprises and still bounce back strongly. We want people that have Silvercrest in their portfolio. And if things go really ugly, they just don't have to worry about us to the same extent they'd be worrying about some of the other names they might own. And if we can have that approach, these big funds, they need to own us for the downside just as much as the upside, right? These are funds that need to be there in the sector year round. And if we can hold on better than the people and weather that storm, then we're going to get, maybe they own us for half a position. And whenever the stock rolls over, they buy more. If the stock rips and goes crazy, they can trim some here and there. But that growth that might come with time and the, how active we are in the drill bit, we've always gotten there. I don't know, maybe one day it'll stop, but we've always been able to keep up with the growth model. And that's free cash flow. Like I said, for us, that free cash flow is extremely unique. So it's a vehicle that gives you inflation protection while giving you income. I mean, CryptoGold doesn't give you income. The dividend yield on the gold index is higher than the S&P and the Dow. So again, you're getting a lot of the things that people say they like in a name, but yet no one's really come to the space yet. So we're just trying to batten down the hatches. We're trying to make sure we don't do anything silly. We're trying to be careful with everybody's money. And to investors and saying, hey, I own half a position. You know, when I talk to a retail broker, I would love for them to have it in all of their portfolios for their clients, but in a small amount. And if they like what they see, they can buy more. If the market rolls over and there's an opportunity to get it on sale, you can buy more. But if we want investors to look at us and say, you know, we trust your approach. We trust your business model. You know, we want you guys to have a reasonable cost of capital to manage assets. So I think, you know, we want to make that appeal to shareholders and say, hey, we got that downside, hopefully, knock on wood. We got the asset quality and we got the team that's done it before. And there's a really interesting next 24, 36 months in front of us here with no more stock coming to market, right? And I think that's a big part now that we've kind of gotten through that is we got our NOBO list. And for people who don't know what that is, it stands for non-objecting beneficial owner. So if anyone's got a retail account, you tick a box and it either tells people what you own or not, whether you've ticked that box or not. So we have 33,000 retail investors. And if you wanted to assume the $15,000 per person, that's $500 million. So we want those people in for the long haul. At the same time, we think we know where about 60-65% of our float is for big, happy institutional guys. So again, we want people to kind of buy it for the long haul, buy bits and pieces. But the fact that we have this much growth and free cash flow in front of us and our stock is this tightly held, You know, anyone who thinks it's interesting down the road, you know, the stock hopefully isn't as cheap down the road as it might be today. So we just want people to buy it for the protection, as well as what's starting to get on the people's tongues, which is that inflation and growth and free cash flow story that a lot of the rest of the market is a little harder to come by.
All right, Chris, we're wrapping up the first hour here. Thank you again for your insights, both on what's going on with Silvercrest Metals and also some of those macro comments. Again, for everyone listening on the radio, you can listen to all of these segments in their longer forms on our website, kereport.com. And everybody, please keep in touch. My email is fleck@kereport.com. Send me your questions for the companies I've been featuring this week or any other companies that you are interested in. I'll happily follow up and get those addressed for you. I hope everybody has a great rest of your weekend. Thanks for tuning into the first hour. The second hour on the weekend show will be focused again more on the company updates from this week. Everybody, Chris, thanks for your time this weekend. Thanks for taking some time with us, and I hope you all have a great weekend.
Thanks, Chris.